This is a No Dogma podcast, and today I'm joined by Mads Torgersen, lead designer for C# at Microsoft, and he's joining me for Seattle. Thank you very much for taking time out of your morning, Mads.
Thanks for having me on again.
It's yes, this is your second great. Time.
It is my second, yes.
The first time we were talking about C#7, and today we're going to talk about C#8. But for people who didn't hear that one, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Well, so for many years, I worked as a what we call a program manager at Microsoft. And I've for that whole time, I've been on the C# team, working with Anders Heilsberg in the beginning. And now that he's on TypeScript, I've taken over the responsibilities for designing C#, essentially, for the leading the evolution of the language.
How long have you been doing that for?
Well, I joined Microsoft almost 14 years ago into the beginning of this role. I can't even remember when Anders switched over to mainly TypeScript. It was all a bit blurry because we both went and did TypeScript for a while and put C# on hold for like a year or so. And then I came back and he didn't. So maybe 7 years ago, something like that.
So prior to that, though, and this was something I didn't know until we met in London at NDC, you were in academia and you are a doctor.
Yeah, I guess you can call me doctor. I have a PhD in computer science. And I fashioned myself a researcher. So I got a PhD and I worked in academia as a professor, you know, started out as assistant professor, then associate professor. I was on that whole track for like 4 years after my PhD. And during that time, I had lots of interactions with industry, in particular with what was then Sun Microsystems and their work on Java. And, you know, I found that I had a lot of fun doing that, and that, you know, they were paid much better than I was doing it. So, for, you know, various reasons, it felt to me like maybe my career was actually elsewhere. And then I ran into Anders Heilsberg at a conference in Denmark, where he's also from, and got a job offer.
And then you moved to Seattle?
Yeah, took the whole family, moved to Seattle. Intending to have an adventure of maybe 2 to 5 years, just do the America experience and then back home, of course. But it's been 14 years and counting, and we're here for good now.
Obviously a different path for me, but I moved from Budapest to here, originally from Ireland, but it was with the idea of staying 3 to 5 years, and that's 12 years ago, and you know, it's settled at this point.
Yeah, yeah, things happen. You get a new normal, and then that's what you, all of a sudden, that's the basis of your decisions, right?
So the last time you were on, as we said, we talked about C#7, and today we're going to talk about C#8. So the first thing is, what's new, what's different that you like?
Well, C#8 has a couple of what I would call major features. We weren't consciously trying to have a theme for C#8, but we sort of realized as Dustin and I were preparing our talk at Build recently, we sort of realized there was a little bit of a common theme across many of the features in C#8, which is it's sort of about robustness or raising the level of abstraction to create a pit of success, something like that. Like, so they're all about, I can write things more succinctly or more precisely so that my code gets better. And I want to say that the major feature that is going to affect a lot of people, like pretty much everyone, is what we call nullable reference types. And that is our effort at, you know, finally making a serious dent in the ever-present risk of getting null reference exceptions, you know, in production code, and trying to help you track whether things can or should be null at certain points in your program at compile time, rather than blowing up in some random place where a null flowed to from somewhere else in somebody else's code, somebody else's library that you were using or whatever. You can actually track it where it happens in the at compile time. That's the point of that feature. But it's pretty impactful. Syntactically, it's very light, but it's pretty impactful because it involves talking about nullability as part of your method signatures and so on. So for every parameter, every result, you can state whether it's supposed to be null or not. And that, of course, is like everything's a signature, right? So using methods all the time. And so that will touch everyone. And then there are pretty significant other features. There's async streams, which kind of does to streaming data what async did to single results, which is create an asynchronous way of consuming things that come at you, maybe over the wire or from some computation or an IoT device or whatever. So that's sort of the next step of async, if you will.
I'm going to come back to async in a little while, but one of the things kind of related to the nullable reference, I know this isn't a breaking change, but would you ever consider introducing breaking changes as the language advances?
Well, in general, I want to say no. We don't like, I mean, there's a lot of C# source code out there. We don't have any realistic even estimate of how much that is, but billions and billions of lines of code are out there. And it would be a shame if the new C# compiler couldn't compile all that code. So we're not really interested in breaking anybody's code. The closest we got ever is actually nullable reference types, which do, since they do intend, their purpose is to help you find places in your code where you may be doing something that's quote unquote null unsafe, then they will raise warnings on things that didn't previously have warnings. I mean, that's the whole point, right? Is to tell you about problems that we didn't tell you about before. And so you can sort of see that as a breaking change. Hey, I'm getting new warnings on my existing code. What's with that? And so because of that, we did put it behind a flag that we expect that in a couple of years' time, certainly for new code, that flag is probably on by default and everybody's using it, but it needs to be behind a flag so you don't inadvertently just all of a sudden get a sea of red, or at least a sea of green, since they're warnings, on your existing well-tested code.
Because I imagine some people's unit tests warnings will generate, you may not pass your unit test if you get a certain number of warnings in your code.
Right. I mean,
that criteria.
Yeah, the tests themselves may, if they run, they might pass, but you know, they might also have warner's errors. That's very common. And so you wouldn't even be able to compile your unit tests anymore.
You touched on it a tiny bit about not knowing how much C# is out there. But I remember, Visual Studio 2015 or 2017, it and Visual Studio Code, they gather a lot of statistics about what people are doing. Is that useful to you in knowing what C# elements are in use?
Not as much as it probably could be. We look at a few things, but we could probably be more systematic about it. And at the core of things, we don't gather telemetry in the compiler, in the C# compiler. It's used for all kinds of purposes, and we don't want it to have, you know, as its job to beam back data to Microsoft or something. That would be bad, right? So we can't sort of directly ask the compiler, hey, what features are you compiling right now when it's out there doing its work? A couple of things we can do is we could maybe sample as part of some of the Visual Studio telemetry. And another thing we can do is to survey, and we've done this a couple of times, all the source code that's on GitHub. So one kind of would give a picture of what features are being used right now, and the other would give a picture of what sort of the cumulative use of language features over time, where obviously newer features haven't had as much time to get into source code. So this is something that I think we're going to do more than we have so far, in a sense, because unlike a button in a UI, you can't change your mind about a language feature. Tracking very deeply how well a feature is doing is a little less useful. It's still useful, and we could do better at it, but it's a little less useful because you did it and you can't really change your mind, right? So maybe it would only be useful to determining our rewards, you know, like, do we get a bonus or not? Well, that depends. But I do want to get better at it. It kind of indicates whether an area of the language should see more attention or whether we should sort of just leave well enough alone.
I get the impression that Visual Studio 2019 is doing something, kind of looking at usage when it's the IntelliCode feature. So it will order the likelihood of a particular method being used. So if you had, you know, something that string and you put a dot, it'll give you kind of the top five most likely things you'd want. And I think that's being sourced off GitHub as well.
Yes. I believe it's a combination of, I'm no expert on this feature, but I believe it's a combination of, seeding it with data from GitHub, just looking at public repos there. And also, I believe some personalization, like, you know, keyboard on the phone or something suggesting the things that you're most likely to want to type next.
When you're using GitHub as a source for sort of the usage of C#, how do you account maybe for kind of a bias towards people publishing things that are good as opposed to all the stuff that's, you know, inside organizations that's never made public and we know a high percentage of that's not particularly good?
We can't really account for it per se. The only thing we can do is take it with a huge grain of salt. I think every decision we make around the language has to be based on many, many different sources of information. We can't just say, oh, let's look at GitHub and make a choice, right? For starters, as I said, it's skewed towards features that have been there longer just because more code has accumulated. And as you point out, there are many other ways in which it may not be representative of all the source code out there in a good way. So it's just one of many sources of data. Honestly, the things that are most actionable or that have most likely impact on where we take the language, they have to be obviously much more leading indicators. So they are more general things about what are people trying to do in code but struggling with or finding, unintuitive or inefficient or hard to express. And then trying to, you know, so through some combination of theft and innovation, you know, try to come up with the ways that we can tackle the top ones of those within C# or within the .NET stack, including C#.
On the point of performance, I think it was Ben Watson's book I was reading some time back, and he talked about string as being a very difficult thing to get to do right so that it's always performant. And what he said, I think, was that when C# was incorporating string, which was needed, it was thought that it wouldn't be used that much and the future isn't strings. But, yeah. You know, I think in my own code, there were things that I'm doing very poorly until I read his book and now I'm doing them better. But I get the impression string is still a hugely important and a performance issue.
It is. And, you know, who would have thunk? Not only did the world become distributed, but one of the primary ways in which, code running on different machines talk to each other is through string-based protocols. Yikes,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And we kind of should have known XML was the first sort of hint at this. And now there's also JSON everywhere and so on. And by then we had settled hard on Unicode as the string representation in C# also. So not whereas now the sort of the cloud, the web, everyone have sort of settled around UTF-8. And so not only do we have a string abstraction that's a little heavy on allocation and so on, because strings are immutable and the sort of classic operations on them are, you know, just a little on the expensive side, as you found from that book, but also we have the wrong format for interoperating with the rest of the world. So that has put us in a bit of a bind, and we're sort of, you can sort of say we're in the middle of a push to make that better. We already have better abstraction. So I want to mention span of T is one of the big things that we put out as a collaboration between language runtime and library that allows you to work with these chunks of data much more efficiently, with much less copying and much more safety than you have with arrays or with, you know, unsafe code. But that's only half of the problem. We also need to deal with the UTF-8 problem, and that's something that we're still working on, but that we want to embrace. And that's probably going to lead to some changes in C#, or probably to the language itself embracing UTF-8 in some way that we're not quite settled on how yet. But there are a couple of options on the table.
Is or would changing string from immutable to mutable, would that be a breaking change?
I mean, technically, not a breaking change per se, because, hey, it would just allow you to start doing something you couldn't do before. So it wouldn't cause compiler errors or anything like that, but it would certainly break a lot of people's invariants. Right? Yeah. People have to be careful about when they share mutable things. Shared mutable state is dangerous. So it wouldn't be breaking per se, because nobody in existing code are mutating strings right now, but your expectation that the string remains the same and nobody else is tinkering with it that you're sharing it with would break. And so all of a sudden your code would become very vulnerable.
This is
one of the problems with arrays as well, that because they are mutable, like they're sort of a fundamental chunk of data kind of data structure, but one of the problems with them is that they're mutable, and so sharing them comes at huge risk, and people do a lot of copying to keep them safe.
And finally,
so making strings mutable would not be a good idea. I mean, that's not how to address this. We have to use abstractions like span or span itself to work on chunks of data where there are strings embedded in, so to speak. Like you can look at a window of a piece of memory and look at the string content there. And you can do that either through a mutable span or a read-only span, share it in that same way, and then avoid the copying costs that are one of the reasons why string manipulation is so expensive, copying and allocation.
And to flog the string one more time, would it be possible to have a second string type, a mutable string?
Well, we sort of already do. We have the string builder.
String builder, yeah.
But it's just not... It's not a good exchange type, right? You have these types that are meant to share things broadly around, and string is that. And if it's mutable, well, you just... As I just explained, you're signing up for trouble. But so we may need another string type, but it won't be a mutable string type per se. I think if we need another one, it's more to handle a UTF-8 problem if we choose to do that as a separate string type.
Gotcha. I'm going to bring us back to some of the features of C#8. And I know you touched on it, the async streams. But can you go in a little more detail as to maybe what the difference between this is what we had before and why it's of benefit?
Well, so you can express streams today, or pre C#8, you can express streaming data through IEnumerable of T is sort of the core abstraction there. And if you're dealing with databases and so on, it'll often be the iQueryable interface that you use, which derives from IEnumerable. And that can represent lazily produced data pretty well, or data that arrives over time. But the weakness of it is that it's a fundamentally synchronous data structure. So when you want the next piece of data, as in a for each loop, or you call the move next method, that call is blocking until that next bit of data is produced. So if that goes all the way through the database, as you're calling to the database and everything, you know, you can have a thread there blocked waiting for a long time. And that's the kind of problem that async was created to solve. We never made the we did it very well for single values, I think, but we never made the jump to doing it for asynchronous streams. And one of the reasons we didn't do it right away, we had the idea for iasync enumerable even way before we shipped async, but we didn't do it because we didn't know how to do it efficiently. And we've since sort of gotten matured the async infrastructure to a point where we have a variant of the task type that's called value task that can be used without allocation, and that can that means that we can represent these asynchronous streams in a way that doesn't allocate per element and in general don't have the amount of overhead that that async had in the beginning. And so now we're confident introducing an abstraction for asynchronous streams that is performant, that avoids too much allocation.
So it was one thing we were chatting about in the prep for the interview. I recently published a blog post on using Entity Framework Core in Web API Core, where I send the queryable out through the action result. So I have a queryable of type product, or iQueryable type product equals context.products.where, no to list or anything, and then I return that queryable. And what I get is fantastic memory performance. And what we were discussing was whether this was a stream or an async stream. And you explained it to me.
Well, it's streaming, right? It's doing one thing at a time and not storing up intermediate results. So it is doing the performance-wise, it's doing the right thing in that sense. But if you want to consume it, you're still the thread that's consuming it element by element is still, by for eaching over it, is still doing so synchronously, blocking every time. So if you have the thread to spend and you don't mind that, then that's fine. But if you have many of these or lots of things going on, or you have just the one thread because you're the UI thread or whatever, you know, as always with async, you don't have a thread to spend. And so async is better.
Gotcha. So one thing I forgot to mention, I also use asNode tracking, but that's just in case someone's listening. But when async streams come out, will I be able to do what you're talking about with this? I'd be able to return a queryable asynchronously so that for each isn't hanging around holding a thread?
I believe so. There's a set of... what you need is essentially an iasync queryable. And I can't remember. So the whole topic of async link has been addressed by the interactive framework that is picking up iasync enumerable and writing link queries over them. And I can't remember if they also in the release that they're putting out alongside .NET 3.0, if they have an iasync queryable yet. But if they don't, then they probably will at some point. I'd have to look it up. But yep. There's no reason why you can't combine asynchrony and queryable.
That'll be great. I'm going to move on to one more thing about C# 8, and there's improved pattern matching. So I think, was it 7.1 or 7.2 that you started pattern matching?
7.0,
I'm sorry. So what has improved now in 8?
There are a few things. In the patterns themselves, the patterns themselves can now be recursive, which means that you can have a pattern once you match a certain type or whatever, you can have a pattern that sort of pulls that apart and applies patterns to its parts in the same pattern, either by name of properties or through using a deconstructor that's in there in the type. So you can have more complex patterns and, you know, use them carefully, but they can be just what the doctor ordered in order to precisely express what you want to say. We also, you know, one of the places where patterns can be used since C#7.0 is in switch statements. And switch statements are very clunky and old-fashioned. They're sort of one of the original Koenig and Ritchie C control structures, and you can feel it. And I mean, they're probably 50 years old as a concrete syntax, or close to 50 years. So, it we felt the need for something a little more spiffy here. And again, looking to functional languages, as we always do, they have what they often call a match expression, that is essentially, you know, a switch statement, but as an expression where you can match on several different patterns and then give an expression for what the result is if that pattern matches. And we now have that. We called it the switch expression. We reuse the switch keyword, but now it's an expression form. And it's we sort of redid the syntax, so it's much more compact and clean, easy to read.
A more broad few questions for you. I think you said that C# 8 has to come out after .NET Core 3. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, the plan is for them to come out at the same time in September of this year. And the reason is that, like earlier versions of C#, C# 8 also has some new library dependencies. It expects certain types to be there, and they're offered up in the new version of .NET Core. But also, this time around, for the first time in over a decade, there's a feature in C# 8 that actually relies on a new runtime feature. So it can't actually, if you use that feature, it can't even run on the existing runtimes. That's a feature of default implementations in interfaces where, you know, to make a long story very short, a member in an interface can have a default implementation associated with it that gets used if nobody implements that member of the interface. But that requires the runtime to know about it. And we decided, hey, now's the time to start playing with adding features to the runtime again, which we haven't really done since generics.
That's a while ago. Was that?
That's a while.
Was it .NET 2?
It was .NET 2, yeah. It came out with Visual Studio 2008 in 2008.
Another thing that there used to be a strong relationship...
No, 2005. Sorry, getting mine. So, long time.
Another thing I think there used to be a strong relationship between was the releases of major C# versions and Visual Studio versions, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Well, Visual Studio has changed its release model to have a frequent cadence. It has updates every couple of months.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the strong coupling between .NET and Visual Studio has loosened somewhat over the years. You know, .NET is now cross-platform, and there's also many different IDEs that you can use for writing C#. We ourselves have VS Code as well. We have VS for Mac, which is sometimes on a slightly different schedule. But there's also things like Writer out there. That's also a C# IDE that's produced by JetBrains. And so we don't really... First of all, we can't just think of these two as joined at the hip anymore, and we also really don't need to. So the schedules of .NET and Visual Studio have sort of split, if you will. And then the last major release of Visual Studio, VS 2019, which I believe came out in February, did not have a new version of C# in it or aligned to a new version of .NET. And then on the other hand, when .NET Core 3.0 and C# 8 come out in September, there will not be a new major version of Visual Studio accompanying that. There'll just be a Visual Studio update that has the support for them. And that's, you know, there's really no good reason anymore for having them tied, and being independent makes it a lot easier to do things when they should be done.
So one thing you couldn't tell me when we talked about C# 7 was a release date, but now it sounds like you do. You have an exact date, or is it sort of sometime in September?
There might be an exact date, but I don't actually have it in my head. So I could probably tell you if I did. You can look it up on the net and see how specific we are.
No problem.
We did. This is sort of like a big turning point for how we talk about things. But at Build, we did announce not only that .NET Core and C# 8 come out in September, but we also announced a fixed cadence for .NET going forward. So there'll be a long-term support release, probably .NET Core 3.1 in November. And then from then on, we will release a major version of .NET every year in November.
And then the next one's going to be 5.
The next one's going to be called .NET 5. Yeah. And we're sort of dropping the core moniker at that point because we, as you know, we've stopped adding major new things to the .NET framework train, so it's not going to get new innovation, and actually not all of the C# 8 features even are going to work on the latest .NET framework. .NET framework is in maintenance mode, effectively, for a long, long time. Like, people should definitely not feel pressured to rush out and try to port all their .NET framework-based stuff to .NET Core. It's going to work just fine, but and we're going to keep maintaining it and keeping the tooling good and so on. But all the new innovation goes into .NET, the .NET Core train, which is also getting merged with the Xamarin train. That was sort of the third big .NET that we were releasing. So in the .NET timeframe, November of next year, November of 2020, the plan is for the Xamarin and .NET Core stacks to have merged. And then the time is to shorten the name and say, now this is what .NET is now, and we're calling it .NET 5. That way we get beyond the existing numbers that we have out there and get a clean start, with a clean merged start with .NET 5.
I'm going to move to some questions we got on Twitter. So when we were arranging this podcast, I tweeted it out and I got quite a few questions. I'm going to apologize to anyone's name I mispronounce. I'm going to go quickly, relatively quickly through them. So there's one from Greg Ingram. Understanding things change, priorities, resources, time, etc. How likely is it for the new records and roles feature shown at the end of build 2019 is going to make it into C#, let's say C# 9, he's saying?
So both of those, so he mentioned records, and I want to add to that discriminated unions as sort of a related feature. And then there's a feature that we call roles. And the latter is definitely more speculative than the former. I want to, now that we're really wrapping up C# 8, I want to double down on getting records and discriminated unions as the major feature in C# 9. That's my goal. There may be all sorts of ways that this will not happen the way I intend it, but and we definitely have design work ahead of us, so there might be snags that I haven't thought about, but I want this to be in the next C#. As for the roles and extensions stuff that I showed as speculative, that needs more bake time than, you know, I don't want to, one way of putting it is, I don't want to push out C# 9 to when that stuff is ready. So that's probably for a later version of C#. But it's something that we want to move forward with and start doing that baking and the feasibility analysis of it.
I'll move on to the next question from Almo. When are updates coming to expression trees like question operator and tuple constructors?
Yeah, the question dot operator.
Question dot, excuse me. Thank you.
That's a good question. You know, we've looked at several times whether to go back. So, okay, here's the problem. Expression trees are an API, a .NET API that represents C# and VB expressions. So it's a metaprogramming sort of API. And we thought we were really nifty. We were really nifty in C# 3 and the accompanying VB that you could write a lambda expression and have it translated automatically into an expression tree. But of course, whenever you introduce a new representation of your language, then you also introducing a tax forever on what do you do with new features in the language? Should they be represented in, for instance, in expression trees? And we did evolve expression trees for the following version and for reasons of supporting the dynamic language feature. But we did not evolve the ability of translating lambdas into those new expression tree things. And that was partly because we didn't get to it, but it was also partly because we're a little worried that if we roll that forward, then we'll break a lot of link providers that expect to only find certain things in their expression trees. So we kind of put ourselves in a quandary there where we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. And so we didn't for a long time. And now we're at a point where there'd be a lot of catch up to do. And also we'd still potentially break all those link providers. And also the people who worked on expression trees aren't even on the team anymore. So it'd be a lot of ramp up for us to make sure we did the work properly. So it irks me a lot that we have this thing in the language that doesn't evolve with the rest of the language. But at the same time, trying to be realistic, I don't see us changing that.
Question from Ed Blackburn. What's your position on 1, compiler flags that permit breaking backwards compatibility, and 2, the compiler backend building an AOT statically linked bin?
Well, both of those are things that we're dipping our toes in, actually. The compiler flags we talked a little bit about already with the nullable reference types. We don't generally want... So some languages do this where they say, we don't like how we did this. Let's change it in the next version and then put it under a flag so that... Or some actually don't even put it under a flag. But, you know... let's change our minds and just let people select whether they want the old or the new version. And I don't think we're going to do that. I think that the flaking of the ecosystem that'll happen if you change your mind like that is just is not worth it for almost anything. I haven't seen a thing yet that I would do it for. So let's not do that. But we did introduce sort of a breaking change, as we talked about with nullable, where you get your warnings if you want to, and you kind of have to say that you want to, because getting a warning is a breaking change, especially if you have Warner's error. So technically, yes, and we just did it. But the sort of more general philosophy of language design through changing your mind, that's not in the cards. And for the other question about backend building an AOT. So we do have AOT backends, ahead of time compilation backends. The standard .NET Core, or Core runtime, for instance, and also the classic CLR, they have a JIT where they compile things just in time while the program is running. They compile them from intermediate language down to the machine code of whatever platform they're running on. And that's the standard mode that most people used to. But we do actually have ahead of time versions of .NET, including the Xamarin that targets iOS, for instance. For many years, you weren't allowed to run a JIT on iOS. And so there's an AOT, a mature AOT stack there where we just compile ahead of time. It comes with some limitations, but it mostly just works. So actually, a big part of the plan for .NET 5, which we mentioned, is what we're doing in releasing in November 2020, as we're merging the mono-based, Xamarin-based stacks with the .NET Core-based stacks, is that we're going to have a choice in the runtime. We're going to have both a JIT and an AOT-based runtime that... You know, all the libraries on top are the same. All the tooling is the same. The languages are the same. But you can, maybe the garbage collectors may be the same, but you can switch between whether you compile ahead of time or whether you rely on the JIT. And in the ahead of time scenarios, hopefully we can build in some leeway in terms of you specifying a more limited environment where you don't need all the reflective code generation capabilities at runtime and so on that the language and that we currently offer. So the short answer is, yeah, we're doing it.
Well, you've also introduced tiered jitting as well.
Yeah.
Is that, how new is that?
It's very new.
Okay.
It's not something we've done before, and we're still tinkering with it. It's other runtimes out there are much more mature, have done this for many years. It's something that we're playing with to see if it... We've been having good efficiency with just running the JIT as a kind of one-step compilation. But there are certainly scenarios where we could eke out some more performance by having a quick and dirty compilation first and then a smarter compilation of things that are visited a lot, of what you sometimes call hotspots in the execution path.
Yeah. I'll move us on to the next question, and it comes from Gregory Zach. He's asking about type providers, but for real, without type erasure, he says. And then the second thing is async await inside link expressions.
Okay, so they're really so two separate questions. But type providers, for those few of you out there who aren't F-sharp experts, type providers is a feature that F-sharp has had for many years, which allows types to be generated or pretended to be generated on the fly as you're coding by a plugin to the compiler, essentially called a type provider. So you can build a type provider for a specific domain or scenario. For instance, one that provides types for, let's say, JSON data based on some schema, based on an exemplar. One, types based on Excel spreadsheets or whatever. There are all these type providers that can let you program against these things as if you had a strongly typed model for them. But the strongly typed model is actually being generated by this compiler plugin as you type, giving you IntelliSense and all that. And it's a very compelling experience. And it kind of helps guide your programming to doing the right thing. And then typically, type providers don't, the types that they generate are just for the benefit of the programmer. They're actually erased and don't exist in the runtime code. The type provider generates some untyped code that is just what runs at runtime. Is what you would have written if you didn't have a type provider. You can also, the type providers do actually, and I think that's what they're alluding to by saying for real without type erasure, you can actually have type providers in F-sharp also generate the types and really use them at runtime. So that's an option you have. Now, I don't think that we're going to have type providers the way F-sharp has them in C-sharp for a couple of reasons. None of them are really about dissing what they have, which is pretty impressive, but just thinking about maybe taking it in a slightly different direction. So two problems that type providers have that I would like to try to avoid. One of them is the types that are generated don't actually exist with a name. So you can only ever use type inference. You can never say the name of the type. You can never create one. You can never have it as a parameter type in your method or something like that. So they don't really have full existence, if you will. And the other problem is that it's a compiler plugin, and running user code as part of the compilation process is something that I would want to be a little bit careful with, like part of even the code generation. I think that not only can bad things happen that are hard to trace in the end product, but they can also quickly become a drag on performance that's really hard to debug, performance of the compiler itself. So we'd be extremely wary of that. Now, there are probably things that we can do. And somebody earlier asked about the roles work that we showed, these ideas that we showed at Build. One of the goals of the roles work is to be able to provide thin wrapper types for essentially untyped data in C#, and give you a strongly typed experience, but with named types over things that don't actually have those types at runtime. And maybe we could use something like on the side generation of these wrapper types ahead of time, and then you can use those as part of your development experience. You can get that same strongly typed experience, actually have named types that you can use, but still have them not necessarily show up at runtime or play a smaller role at runtime. So we're looking at that. We're thinking about those scenarios that type providers address, but we want to do it differently and not as part of the core compilation pipeline.
Gotcha. Then the second part of this question was about async await inside link expressions.
Yes. So the link syntax today, the query expressions where you say from blah de blah where something something, that syntax does not, currently you can't put an await inside of those query clauses. So you can't ask an asynchronous question as part of your where clause establishing whether an element should be in the output stream or not. And that has to do with how the language interprets those query expressions. They're compiled down in a very sort of syntactic sugar kind of way into method calls with lambda expressions. And those lambda expressions aren't async, and so therefore you can't say await in them. And that's the, you know, that's just the core reason. There's no reason why we couldn't allow that, but we'd have to decide whether, you know, there's a little bit of language design around, do we just implicitly make them async, or when there's an await, or do you have to explicitly opt into it and stuff like that. So we just haven't really fleshed it out. We wanted to see how much of a groundswell demand there is for this, or whether it's not all that important. So we'll see.
Next question from Yair Halberstad. Are there any plans to release discriminated unions within the C# 9 timeframe?
Yes. I think discriminated unions and records are related features that should go out together. And my current thinking is that they are the defining feature of C# 9. C# 9 is ready only when those features are there. That is, I may change my mind on this, but my current thinking on it is that that's how it works. So I can't tell you when C# 9 is, because on Dike.net, we haven't yet published a versioning scheme, or committed to one. But I would like C# 9 to not be too far in the future, and I would like it to have both records and discriminated unions, and we're working on it.
All right, last question from Twitter, from Tornai Karashvili. Do you like TypeScript-style inline union types, and can we fit that into C#?
Yes and no.
Can you elaborate on the no?
I can elaborate on both. I like them. The union types are part of a very... TypeScript has an enormously structural type system. I mean, it's one of the most structural type systems in any commercial language out there. It's really pushed the boundaries of structural type systems. Where structural type system means that, you know, the types apply to anything that have the right shape. An object doesn't have to declare to be of a type in order to be of one. It just has to have the right shape. And that works really well with union types, which are structurally combined. You say a union type essentially say it's either that or that or that kind of thing. And then that the type, you can just express a type that consists of those three things and nothing else. And it works really well with flow analysis of the flow of the code, where the compiler can look at tests and can see, oh, he just did a test where, you know, it can no longer be that thing, because then we were taking a different branch, and it can automatically narrow the types of these union types depending on where you are in the program. We actually do a little bit of that with the nullable reference types in C#, where you can think of a nullable reference type string question, for instance, as being the union of string and null. Like, it's either a string or it's null. And then based on the ifs, the tests you have in your program, we can see whether it can be null here or not. But they do that completely generally with union types in TypeScript. And it's very expressive. But it also needs to be in order to rein in some of the crazy coding patterns that people have in JavaScript. So they need this expressive type system in order to make compile time sense of the stuff that people are doing in JavaScript at a regular basis. We have a nominal type system on .NET that, you know, where you have to declare the relationship between a value and its type, or, you know, and all the type relationships have to be pre-declared essentially. And in that kind of environment, it's difficult to have these sort of ad hoc union types that you can just create on the spot. We talked about discriminated unions where you declare a name type ahead of time that can be this or that or those, and it comes with a built-in method of distinguishing which one it is. And now it's a name type that you use. So a more declarative version of unions, a more nominal one, is likely to seed into C#. But not the wildly structural ones. The one of the aspects of the roles work again is that it it's also intended to soften that a little bit, where if we ever succeed in actually fully designing and implementing it, it would allow you to introduce new type relationships in certain scenarios. Like you can declare that a given class implements a given interface, even though neither the class nor the interface actually knew about each other when they were declared. So that's sort of like trying to approach some of the structuralness or some of the benefits of structural types. And maybe that would interact with unions somehow, but I can't, not in a way that I can think of right now.
Can I ask you one more question if you have time?
Sure.
What's the relationship within your organization between, let's say, your C-sharp team and your compiler team? What do you do that's the same? What do you do that's different?
Well, so there is a C-sharp design team, but it's a virtual team. There's no, it's not a team of people who work on it full time and have a shared manager. The C-sharp design team is pulled together of people from different, you know, physical or actual teams. One of them being the compiler team, which the compiler team is the set of engineers that are responsible for the C-sharp and VB compilers, as well as the sort of lower levels, the language levels, if you will, of what we call the Roslyn API, which is the, you know, the public API through which you can inspect and create C-sharp and Visual Basic programs with full fidelity. And that's sort of the groundwork of the compiler itself. So there's a team of, I want to say about 9 or 10 people that build that for C-sharp and VB. And some of those people are then on the C-sharp language design team, along with others and along with me, that meet twice a week for 2 hours when we're going at full swing and design the language.
But you're full-time on the language? Is that
pretty much. Okay. I tend to get sucked into a lot of different things, but I'm probably the only one who has it as his full-time job to design C-sharp.
I see.
So I corral these other people on the language design team and drive that process and make sure that we understand what all the features should actually do and, you know, spend time going to conferences and talk about it and so on.
And then do the likes of the .NET teams, .NET Core teams, do they get involved in language design at times?
Yeah, they do. There's two folks from the .NET team that are also on the C-sharp language design team. So they also sent a few folks. And we also have, and on top of that, there's also an IDE team for .NET that does the C-sharp and VB IDE integration, Visual Studio integration, but also Visual Studio Code, and generally they manage the upper layers, the language service layers of the Roslyn APIs. So a bunch of people are involved, different teams, and different physical teams. And then from each of these, we have some people that help with the language design.
Mads, any final notes before we wrap up for today?
Ooh, I didn't prepare like a statement or something.
That's all right.
I guess, a call to action always is there are great previews out there of C-sharp 8. You know, if people can go out and use them, and if they stumble on something, you know, let me know.
What's the easiest way of letting you know?
You can tweet at me, which I'm not that regular, but I will get there. I mean, that's one way of letting me know. Or if you're just in there in Visual Studio, use the feedback mechanism in there. The various ways that we can get it to the
GitHub
team.
Issue? Would that be
GitHub
okay?
Issue too, yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah, if you are interested in the details of language design, C-sharp language design, go to .NET/C#lang under GitHub and look at that repo. And that's where all the notes from the design meetings and so on come out in real time. And lots and lots of discussion takes place there.
I'll put the links into the show notes.
Great.
Mads Torgersen, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was awesome.
If you like this episode, you might also like my other episode with Mads on C#7. That's episode 65. or episode 78 with Dustin Campbell on C Sharp 7.1, or episode 73 with Bill Wagner on the Microsoft Documentation Service. The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Allude by Lee Roser V from the album Blue Dot RMX.